Tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
In fact, the first war on terrorism was the Reagan administration, and the focus was on the Middle East. Then, as now, Libya was the chief demon at the time, and right after Reagan came in, they were talking about Libyan hit squads, allegedly on the prowl in Washington or, around the country, and gunning for Reagan and this kind of thing, whipping up the fear. And it's very much like this administration today, and a lot of the people that are serving under Bush were, our Reagan retreads.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the program. Today, we hear from dissident historian and author of the books Portraits of Empire and The Madness of King George, Michael K. Smith. Howard Zinn calls Portraits of Empire a bold, provocative slash through the history of our country. The following is brought to us by Washington State correspondent Tony Zaragoza, taken from a live interview on KZUU's Community Forum Radio. Throughout the program, Michael K. Smith not only reads from Portraits of Empire, but discusses past and present politics. We begin with a question from a caller regarding globalization and democracy.
This is Julia. Julia, go ahead with your question.
Hi. This is somewhat of a topic jump from what you're discussing now, but I was wondering if you could comment on how the current globalizing economy is contributing or not contributing to democracy.
Globalization, yeah, under capitalist relations. Yeah, I don't see it as contributing to democracy. I see it as destroying the prospects for democracy. And if you look at throughout the world, what's called globalization means, losing your autonomy, losing the right to control your economy, and letting those who control capital determine what economic relations are to be, where the jobs are going to be, if any, what the wages are going to be, and so forth, stripping away all regulation and stripping away environmental protection, stripping away benefit packages and this kind of thing. You can't say that's a democratic process. People want all those things, but they can't keep them because they don't, those who control the capital are determined to reduce their costs, and those are costs to them, benefits to us, and they strip them away, and this is happening all over the world. I mean, tremendous dislocations and loss of rights due to what's called the advancing juggernaut of globalization. So I see it as, profoundly anti-democratic. And if you look at the kind of demonstrations that the World Trade Organization is, generating in response, like at Cancun, which was really a victory for the people recently, those protests, that's democracy, is the protest against this, not the promotion of it.
In speaking about democracy and definitions of democracy, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what was going on in California this last couple of weeks with the recall election.
It was really, speaking of democracy, I think a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I think it was an exercise. I mean, it was more democratic than the average election. I mean, if you look at, we had like six debates here with, two, a Green Party candidate, an independent, a Democrat, and a couple of Republicans. Arnold Schwarzenegger only showed up to one of them, but, that was a reasonable range, uncommonly for the United States, a reasonable ideological range represented, and a lot of aspects of state policy were discussed. So to me, I thought that was very gratifying. I thought, well, this is, I've never seen that in this country, where there's anything beyond the liberal-conservative divide, which, is usually almost pointless to watch. I mean, they're so filled with cliches and just in sort of inside, falsely framed issues that are difficult to follow and this kind of thing. But this time, because of the independents, it was actually quite an interesting series of debates. So I thought it was, the outcome isn't great, but it wouldn't have been great if Gray Davis had been retained. The fact that there were real debates and independents were actually, in on equal terms with the major party candidates, I thought was very much, an exercise in democracy. So I was gratified as far as that went.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate that Arnold Schwarzenegger only chose to get involved in one of the debates, and that was the one in which he had the questions already, so he could pre-script his answer as if it were another movie. That was,
yeah, it was very obvious that's what he was doing, you know, with these sort of one-liner put-downs that he had been ready to leap into the fray and use. It was very predictable, and he didn't really add anything except, in terms of debating, yeah, he didn't, you know, add any insights to policy other than, you know, the state is spending too much money and we're in deficit, and everybody already knew that. So, but, you know, whether he's at worse than the average major party candidate in terms of that, I don't know. In general, I think it's a pretty insulting kind of commentary we get from our politicians, just as a general rule, from the major parties, you know. So whether he's any worse, I don't really know.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. And I mean, my one image of the debate is him just being so nasty and sexist toward Arianna Huffington. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on her candidacy.
Yeah, I liked a lot of what she said and was planning to vote for her until she pulled out at the end, so I couldn't vote for her. I thought she did a, you know, fine job in the debates. And going, you know, head-to-head with Arnold, which was quite aggressive, and I thought that was called for. I mean, he was just, you know, obnoxious, and I was glad that she was quite aggressive around both the Republican, Tom McClintock, and Schwarzenegger about them, you know, criticizing, for example, the deficit in California, which is, you know, should be criticized, but saying nothing about their own party in Washington, which is bankrupting, you know, the whole country. I mean, more than bankrupting. I mean, these kind of deficits we're seeing nationally, no one's ever heard of deficits this size. And they, you know, they were, the Republicans are criticizing Gray Davis. They have nothing to say about their own party, and it's, you know, grotesque fiscal irresponsibility. So she was aggressive on that, and I thought that was good.
Well, I'm wondering what you see as the role that money played in that election, and maybe even looking for a speculation on why you think Schwarzenegger won.
Well, money, you know, it always does in our society. I mean, you can't get anywhere without big money, which is unfortunate. So people like Schwarzenegger have an opening because he has an independent base of financing. Yeah, the role of Daniel Issa was a Republican businessman who got, you know, professional signature gatherers to get, I forget what it was, $1.5 million or $2 million, you know, California voters to sign this petition for the recall and get it on the ballot. And, you know, that's sort of par for the course. I mean, last year it was Gray Davis who he had lavishly funded attack ads, which knocked out the liberal Republican Richard Reardon from contention, knocked him right out, so basically deprived the voters of a choice last year, and he got Bill Simon, who was a much weaker candidate, and Davis knew he could win. So, you know, both parties play this game. Well, how can we use money to basically deprive the voters of any, you know, of much of a choice? You know, how can we just rig the system using our financial backers? So, the Republicans came back with this winning strategy. As far as the voters, I think, you know, they're really, it's kind of similar to the energy, I think, of the Prop 13 back in the late 70s, a property tax revolt when the property values were soaring, and so people's assessments for their homes and stuff were going way up, and they were suddenly getting hit with major tax increases. This time around, it's the energy, so-called energy crisis that Enron engineered by gaming the energy market in 2001, and people's electricity bills went from like $100 a month to $600, $700, $800 a month overnight, and businesses, you know, they went out of business, and it was a real catastrophe. And so people blame Davis for that. He took, I think it was $100,000 from Enron. Both parties supported deregulation. I mean, try to find a politician who doesn't believe that deregulation leads to a better deal for consumers and the whole world. That's just sort of the reigning ideology. Now, Schwarzenegger is likely to be worse, according to Greg Palast. He's got some pieces out recently about how Schwarzenegger's got a deal. He's already made a deal with Ken Lay to you know, so they only have to pay off, you know, pennies on the dollar for the billions that they siphoned out of the state. So as far as, if the voter rebellion was about the energy crisis, this is not going to be a remedy. It's probably going to get worse. But I think the voters just felt that Davis, they hated Davis, and if the Democrats had run someone other than Cruz Bustamante as a replacement, they might well have won. It's not a, I don't think there's any, real, terrific enthusiasm for Schwarzenegger. It's becoming a regular politician, and Gray Davis was the most hated of conventional politicians that it came out the way it did.
Well, in some ways, that reminds me of a former actor turned politician who capitalized on conservative backlash and his name and reputation. And I'm thinking of, obviously, Ronald Reagan. And I'm wondering if you could go back into the book, and maybe on 246 you have a very well-done portrait of Ronald Reagan, and I'm wondering if you could read that for our listeners.
You are listening to People's Tribune Radio. Correspondent Tony Zaragoza is interviewing author Michael K. Smith about his book Portraits of Empire.
Okay, 1985, yeah. Let's see. Oh, 1985, Washington. Ronald Reagan. He has but the foggiest idea what the policies of his own administration are. If not programmed by his staff, he talks nonstop about Hollywood or whiles away the hours watching TV. Bored with his duties, he comes to work reluctantly and nods off in cabinet meetings or amuses himself doodling. His solution for every problem is a dismissive one-liner and an amiable grin. He comes alive for the camera and appears coherent only with the constant assistance of a teleprompter. Unchoreographed moments leave him babbling like a small child. With curious vehemence and farcical regularity, his aides announce that he is in charge and understands what's going on. He thinks by anecdote and debates with sentimental homilies. Facts are blotted out with self-justifying stereotypes of Soviet beachheads, of sponging welfare queens, of educational aid recipients turned stockbrokers, of voluntary ghettos, of communist hordes descending on Texas, of rich kids getting free school lunches. To mobilize support for unpopular budget cuts, he cites anonymous letters from altruistic, blind, elderly, and disabled citizens urging him to slash their benefits for the good of the country. He insists trees are a major cause of air pollution. He says Trident nuclear missiles are recallable after firing and believes the first Strike MX is a peacekeeper. He claims Karl Marx invented the progressive income tax. Returning from a trip to Latin America, he exclaimed that they're all different countries. He once addressed Samuel Doe, head of state of Liberia, as Chairman Mo. One of his children discloses the nominal success. He makes things up and believes them.
Wow, you should have heard the roars of laughter here in the studio as you were reading that. I think, there's one thing that George Bush is also doing in terms of his presidency is sort of modeling him and piggybacking on the image of Ronald Reagan. And I think most folks don't really have a sense of what Reagan was about. And it's portraits like that that clue us into what's going on or not going on in Reagan's head. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the 80s? What were some of the major events? And what is Ronald Reagan's role in guiding the ship?
Well, Reagan, he's kind of an interesting figure. I mean, as I say, he doesn't have the slightest idea what's going on. Probably more than Bush does presently, but not much at all in a general sense. He's under capitalism, the power rests in the private economy and those who control the economic system, and they need kind of like a popular figurehead or someone who can be a symbol of the unity of the country. And Reagan was good at that. I mean, he's good for ribbon-cutting ceremonies and so forth, and someone who can harvest votes, but who generally, doesn't really understand the issues or is not in a position to, really to change anything, not that he wanted to. So it's kind of, a natural tendency in a capitalist system is to generate that kind of leader, who's just sort of a facade for those who really exercise power. And really, the Reagan reaction was underway even before he came into office. I mean, the Carter administration was quite reactionary, too. I mean, there was a massive nuclear buildup, massive armaments, increase in armaments production and expansion of the defense industries, fanning the flames of the Cold War. I mean, I remember that, you know, as soon as they came in, they announced, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. There was a defense guidance plan that came out, a really terrifying-looking document that Caspar Weinberger, who was defense secretary, was going around talking about. There was a war on terrorism. In fact, the first war on terrorism was the Reagan administration, and the focus was on the Middle East. Then, as now, Libya was the chief demon at the time, and right after Reagan came in, they were talking about Libyan hit squads, you know, allegedly on the prowl in Washington or, you know, around the country, and gunning for Reagan and this kind of thing, whipping up the fear. And it's very much like this administration today. And a lot of the people that are serving under Bush were, you know, are Reagan retreads. There was they trashed the PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, right after they came in, and that was, you know, a signal that, you know, unions were going to be crushed and, you know, corporate power was going to enjoy, you know, unrestrained support from Washington, and they did. The defense budget went up, so-called defense went to something like $3.7 trillion in the Reagan and Bush senior years, which is, you know, now it's, you know, well beyond that. So,
why do you say so-called defense? Could you explain that for our listeners?
Well, you know, again, it's a defense of, if it's a defense at all, it's a defense of that, of a worldwide empire that's based maybe mostly in the U.S., but isn't really a defense of the national territory of the U.S. I mean, look at like 9/11. It's kind of, talk about ironic. 19 guys with box cutters, you know, get it, not only get into the country, but, you know, wipe out 3,000 people in a matter of minutes against this huge arsenal. How is that even possible? If we're focused on defending the national territory and we're spending this $300-400 billion a year, year after year after year, to build up our, quote, defense, how is it possible that 19 guys with box cutters can get in and kill 3,000 people? Well, the answer is that we're not really defending the national territory. We don't really, that's not the agenda of the defense industries. It's a massive subsidy to, you know, military contractors, and it's promoting what they call a favorable investment climate, really throughout the world. That's what our military is for. And whether or not it protects the national territory at any given moment is anyone's guess. I think rather it's not. It has nothing to do with that. And I'd actually like to hear sometime from Washington a real plan for defending the national territory of the U.S. That would be kind of a novel thing to hear about.
Well, I guess for me, defending the U.S. or defending human beings generally, or national security or homeland security, would involve everyone eating, you know, as a prerequisite to anything else. Everyone having health care and education and a place to live. I mean, if we're talking about patriotism and love for one's country, I think those are probably the values that need to come first, and not only here but around the world.
Yeah, well, that's pretty, I mean, it is, it's really insulting for to hear our leaders saying how we should just line up, you know, obedience to the latest war they've declared. And, you know, tens of millions of Americans don't have any health insurance, don't have access to it, and more people are losing access to it. I mean, if you count up the people that are, whose employment status is not very secure and, you know, are in and out of insurance programs because their jobs, they lose jobs and they get another one. It may be closer to, you know, 50, 60, 70 million people who have no regular health insurance. And in terms of people who don't feel their health insurance covers all that they might need, it's, you know, these are huge numbers. And, yeah, to say that that our system has any concept of defending the nation, the people who live here in the territory, I think is a misnomer. It certainly doesn't. I mean, you can't allow that kind of circumstance to prevail if you have any real love of country. It seems to me, it's just if you're going to use words properly, love of country has to mean protection of the territory and protection of the people. And I haven't seen any policy along those lines in my entire life.
You are tuned in to People's Tribune Radio's Washington State correspondent Tony Zaragoza interviewing dissident historian Michael K. Smith.
Michael, we're nearing the end of the hour, but I was hoping that you might finish by reading the last portrait of the book, Delusions of Empire. It kind of goes along with what we've been talking about.
The very end, 2003, Washington, Delusions of Empire. This is a quote from Thomas Jefferson. I am persuaded no constitution was ever before as well calculated as ours for extensive empire and self-government. Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, 1809. And this is from the historian William Appleman Williams. I know why I do not want the empire. There are better ways to live and better ways to die. And this is the vignette. Empire was familiar to the colonial leaders who declared their independence from Britain in 1776. Steeped in the classics of ancient Greece and Rome, they spoke of the British Empire freely and described their own aspirations in a similar way. Empire took its place at the heart of all that America was supposed to be. Later generations learned to speak of imperial ambitions as, quote, extending the area of freedom, maintaining territorial and administrative integrity, and saving the world for democracy, unquote. Polite deception was essential to destroying the civilizations of the indigenous population, maintaining slavery, seizing half of Mexico, wresting colonies from Spain, and relentlessly projecting U.S. power throughout the world. The apotheosis came after World War II. Henry Luce declared the American century in the pages of Time. National Security Council Memorandum 68 called for the United States to impose its, quote, order among nations, unquote, so that, quote, our free society can flourish, unquote. Mere containment of the USSR was not enough. Quote, our policy and action must be such as to foster a fundamental change in the nature of the Soviet system, unquote, said this infamous blueprint of the Cold War. Now the champions of empire demand that the Arab states of the Middle East be fundamentally changed. Former CIA Director James Woolsey announces that the U.S. is on the march in support of democratic movements throughout the region. He makes no mention of rampaging Israeli death squads, invading U.S. soldiers, or the swooping vultures of Chevron, Exxon, Bechtel, and Halliburton. Washington's decades of support for feudal dictators and highly undemocratic liberations in Kuwait and Afghanistan pose no obstacle to Woolsey declaring the U.S. to be on the side of the Arab masses.
You just heard Michael K. Smith read from his book Portraits of Empire, Unmasking Imperial Illusions from the American Century to the War on Terror. Michael, do you have any final words for our listeners on history or on any of the other things that we've talked about?
Well, I just say study it. I mean, it's fascinating if you know, if you really get into it, not the conventional histories, which are really a form of mythology, but, you know, real honest historians, it's, you know, as entertainment value, you can't go wrong, and definitely orients you toward the day's news when, you know, you can just pick up a sound, you know, these phony political lines that are being tossed out all the time, just jump out at you when you know a little history, and so you can... you're much less likely to be taken in by the latest news blitz around war promotion or, you know, some fatuous theme that they're coming up with. If you know a little history, it's really good protection against the propaganda system that we're all bombarded by day in and day out.
And you have another book, right?
The Madness of King George, which is a satire on the George Bush with the illustrator Matt Worker. We just put this together over the spring and early summer. That we're hoping to generate a lot of critical energy around Bush and send him back to Crawford. We've had enough of this guy. So we're hoping that'll help with the groundswell that seems to be emerging against Bush, but we'll see.
Well, Michael K. Smith, I want to thank you for being with us on the program, and thanks for all the work that you're doing in the area of history. Thank you again.
All right, thank you.
This is People's Tribune Radio. We just finished listening to correspondent Tony Zaragoza interviewing dissident historian and author Michael K. Smith. If you would like more information about Michael K. Smith's books, check out the Common Courage Press website at www.commoncouragepress.com. Before we conclude our program, I would like to share with you an editorial from the People's Tribune titled, "Anyone But Bush Won't Do." As we enter the election of 2004, it appears as if we are confronted with a major political dilemma. There are many articles that are critical of Bush as an individual. Some articles go further and criticize Rumsfeld and Ashcroft as individuals. However, when we look at the direction we have been headed as a country, it has nothing to do with the actions of individuals. We can trace back from the 1970s to today the greatest shift in policy, along with an incredible transfer of wealth. Bush and this administration have taken bold steps that any new administration will have to continue in some form. Why? Because it is in the interest of the ruling class, a group of influential representatives of the most wealthy and powerful that have determined that this is what must be done in order to maintain their control. From the point of view of the ruling class, the shift in policy in the world requires that the American people accept their lot in fighting the wars that the policy shift necessitates. The changes that are being implemented domestically are being made not to fight terrorists, but to control the opposition to this policy shift. The economy is being reconstructed into a war economy to support this changed role in the world. In the end, democracy, the concept of justice, and our morality and ethics as a people are being reshaped to fit their needs. As much as Bush's policies appear to be his own, and he has become the person we love to hate, the dangers we face are much greater, and we will be lulled into accepting perhaps someone who is only different in degrees and will take us where they want, just not as fast. As a result, we will be changed and will have lost what little control we may have had in the past over the class of people who rule this country based on the interest of the wealthy and demands of the richest corporations. We have a large task of reshaping the most important reality show unfolding before our eyes, being decided in the back rooms by a class of wealthy and powerful people. The country is definitely split, but split by the media and the way they ask the questions and how they promote individuals and ideas. We are building the connections and discussions to formulate a program based in the interests of the poor and working people of the U.S. and the world. It won't be easy, but we must start with asking ourselves the right questions and developing solutions. And it will always be about program. Every campaign, every struggle, every movement against this or that individual or change in policy must be about formulating and promoting our own program and the resources to fight for that program. Bush must be voted out of office, not because we don't like him, but because we fundamentally disagree with his program, no matter what individual or what party is promoting it. This struggle is about fighting for our present and our future. That is it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a society who rallies and reorganizes around the program of those whose needs the capitalist system cannot meet. For more information about the League or to inquire about a speaker, please call 1-800-691-6888. That number again is 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, I would like to thank you and hopes you tune in next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.